Today on Rocking the Suburbs.
The one lawyer said to Davis, you know, did you write this song? And he said, no, it was revealed to me.
Hey everybody, Patrick Foster here. On behalf of Jim Lanahan, I want to welcome you to the third installment of our series on the Reverend Gary Davis. Hope you've been enjoying it so far. And today's episode is just going to continue to add the goodness as the Reverend begins to make an impact with his playing and teaching in New York City and environs. Before we roll the big TDK reel-to-reel tape for part three of this series, I want to remind everybody that on Monday, February 16th, is the January new music series of episodes that will start. So if you want to get your picks in for January 2026 new music, you're still writing 2025 on your checks. All you have to do is send in your picks by the 15th. That's Sunday. Try to get them in by midnight on Sunday the 15th. And we will include them in the series. So there's your January 2026 new music deadline. And with that little piece of business out of the way, I'm ready to listen to some more Kurt Gallagher chatting to us about the Reverend Gary Davis. So I've got the big tape threaded up, the TDK reel-to-reel on my expensive reel-to-reel tape player. And we will hit play for you right now. So he didn't specifically have, in any way, really, a recording career on his mind at this time. Was that because of the fact that it didn't go well the first time he recorded in the 30s?
I think so. I think he almost, I'm not really sure, but he might have just forgot about those recordings because nothing much happened with them until they were rediscovered 30 years later.
Yeah, yeah, interesting.
And he was really into being a preacher.
Was he teaching at this time? Because obviously he was teaching Blind Boy Fuller, but when he first got there, it sounds like mostly he was busking and playing on the street or playing in at churches and things other than taking on students.
He was teaching, but I don't think his teaching really took off until he moved to Queens. But he was teaching. He taught Stephen Grossman, and he taught Stephen Grossman before he moved to Queens. Because he moved to Queens in 1968, but Stephen Grossman studied with him a lot earlier. And that name, Stephen Grossman, is a really important name in the whole Davis story and the whole story of American guitar. But he was a really early student of Davis's after Davis came up to New York.
So tell us a little bit more about Stephen Grossman and why he was as important as he was.
Stephen Grossman was one of Davis's first students, and he was the first person to release a instructional album. He put out an album called How to Play Blues Guitar, which was a vinyl LP, and it came with tabulature, which is like a way of that guitar players learn songs. It has six lines, and each line represents a string. And Stephen Grossman tabbed out all these blues songs, and he had it printed up, and he included it with this album called How to Play Blues Guitar. And that was one of the first instructional materials that you could go buy and listen to and learn how to play some of these songs.
Thank you.
So he's a pioneer, but he went on to do much bigger things later in life. He started Stefan Grossman's Guitar Workshop, but he also started Kicking Mule Record Company. He was half of Kicking mm-hmm. Mule. He was strongly associated with Shanachie and Yazoo. And mm-hmm. he went on to put out all these releases of blues, early blues, and he started collecting all these videos of all these blues players. But always, you know, Davis was at the top of his list, but he was getting videos from all different blues players from all over America. And he was he started making cassette lessons that came along with books. So you would get a book of tablature with a cassette, and people would buy these cassettes and learn how to play guitar from them. And then later he moved into videos. So he started making VHSs and then DVDs, and now you can get his lessons online. And he has an incredible collection of guitar lessons. But there were three companies back then. There was another student of Davis's called Happy Traum, who had a company up in Woodstock called Homespun Tapes. And they also put out lessons on video and DVD and now, you know, just streaming. But these guys did so much to preserve Davis's legacy, sort of like in the oral tradition. But instead of, you know, sitting down with someone, you have a video of someone explaining to you how to play this song. And I actually met Stefan one time. He had this deal where if you bought three, you could get one free. And he put out a bunch of cassettes on Shanachie with tablature. And they were based in Newton, New Jersey. And it was like a 40-minute drive from where I was living at the time. So I just decided to go up to Newton and go to like the factory. And Stefan Grossman, you know, was there, and he took me into the storage room, and he said, you know, which albums did you want? And I picked out like eight albums. And he was, you know, we were talking about it for a little bit, and I didn't know what a famous guy he was, because he's played all around the world with John Fahey and John Renborn, and he's you know, made recordings with lots of amazing people, and he's been always there, you know, teaching Americans how to play guitar, and people all around the world, actually, because he lived in Italy for a while, so he has students all over the world, Stefan. But he was one of Davis's first students.
That's incredible. That's incredible. That he would be at the warehouse and be so down to earth. That's just an amazing story.
Yeah, it was great. And then I went to his house for a workshop about 2 years after that, because in his little catalog, they would send out catalogs every month, and he advertised this workshop. And I went there and spent a day, actually it was a weekend, a Saturday and a Sunday, just playing, learning songs from Stefan Grossman with like five other people. It was amazing.
That is amazing.
And cool, I was young. I didn't know. This was in the early 90s. I didn't know what a legend he was at the time. I'm glad I didn't.
That's incredible.
He was just a nice guy that knew how to play guitar and could teach people. But yeah, he's a living legend. And people should go to Stefan Grossman's Guitar Workshop and look at all the resources there, because he has these videos of all the players. Chicago Blues, Delta Blues, Piedmont. Even like Irish and bluegrass, all kinds of players.
So, you know, it's funny watching that video and listening back to some of this music. I'd really just started connecting your guitar style to Davis and others. And I never really did that when I first heard you play, because I didn't know too much about your background when I first started heard you play on the Hootenanny. But man, the activity on the fret, on the neck, and all that stuff, definitely you can hear all that influence. It's been really neat to kind of connect those two things. And of course, you can find out about Mr. Kurt Music too. We'll talk about that a little later, but that's out there just like Stefan Grossman is. So, one thing that was pretty fascinating to me, and always has been the folk revival. When the folk revival took place in New York City, you know, spearheaded there, I've always found it a fascinating movement in American musical history. It lasted, I don't know how long you would say it lasted. It was a brief fling, relatively, in musical history before the Beatles came along and wiped parts of it out. Right. But It was a huge change for Reverend Gary Davis when the folk movement hit, right?
Yeah, all these people that were part of the folk movement, they knew about Davis, and they were inviting him to parties and stuff. He wasn't really doing gigs at first, but he was always at the parties, and he just loved to be out playing guitar with people. And his students were like David Bromberg, Dave Van Ronk, Roy Bookbinder, Bob Weir took lessons from him, Jorma Kaukonen from Hot Tuna, and Jefferson Airplane took lessons from him. So he knew some pretty big names, and he was at all these parties. So everybody from the folk revival knew Davis. And even on Dylan's first album, there's a Davis songwriting credit, Baby Let Me Follow You Down.
Yep.
Was credited to Reverend Gary Davis on Dylan's first album.
I first heard this from Rick Von Schmidt. He lives in Cambridge. Rick's a blues guitar player. I met him one day in the green pastures of Harvard University. Let me follow you down, baby, let me follow you down. Well, I'd do anything in this God Almighty world if you just let me follow you down. Can I come home with you? Baby, can I come home with you? Yes, I do anything in this God Almighty world.
And I don't know, should we talk about the whole Samson and Delilah thing with Peter, Paul, and Mary?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, you mentioned Bob Weir, and that's an interesting thing in the documentary is, like, here's Bob Weir right at the beginning, you know, basically saying, well, not only it's Bob Weir from the Grateful Dead, wow, I didn't put those two things together. And him, you know, basically saying, well, man, you know, Samson and Delilah was in our sets for, you know, how many years, and I'm sure half the Deadheads thought we wrote it, you know. So it's really kind of a fascinating story. So tell us about that and how that well, it ended up paying for a house.
It did pay for a house for him. So there's a song called Samson and Delilah. Davis did not write it. It was first recorded by a Texas blues player called Willie Walker. Oh, no, wait. No, I'm sorry. Willie Walker was... I might have messed this up. Willie Walker was the Durham Badass. So I messed that up. I said Blind Willie Johnson, but I got confused in my notes here. Willie Walker was the Durham Badass that everybody wanted to be like in Durham. Blind Willie Johnson was a Texas blues man who played he played Piedmont and he played Delta because he wasn't confined to any style because he lived in Texas. But he recorded a song called If I Had My Way, I'd Tear This Building Down. And if you listen to it, it's really raw. It's very raw, but it's got an amazing bounce to it, especially when you get to the verses. It's got this bounce.
Well, if I had my way, if I had a whole week of fun, if I had a Lord just build it down. Well, not a wonder woman, fine fair, a pleasant look, a cold black hair. All the game though, sounds in mine. I first saw the woman, I look so fine. I wear the wind Timothy, I can't tell. A daughter of Timothy, I play that well. The sound that told his father, go in.
If me Lord, if I had my way, well, if I had a wicked one, if I had a long time.
reply to him. Can't you find a woman of your kind and kin? Samson, where'd you please your mother's mind? Go and marry Fatty for last time. Let me tell you what, old Samson, when it broke at the dawn.
I think this song actually was like a gospel song that people sang in church in the South. So I think it just was out there in the ether. It was just existed in the ether in the South in black churches. But Blind Willie Johnson was the first guy to ever record this song way before Davis recorded it. Davis was playing it. I don't know if it's on the 35 sessions. I think it might be. Davis called it Samson and Delilah, even though the other guy, Blind Willie Johnson, called it If I Had My Way. But it's the same song and the same verses and everything. So Davis recorded it. I think he might have recorded it in 35, but he definitely recorded it a bunch of times in the 60s. But Peter, Paul, and Mary caught wind of this song, and they liked Davis's arrangement of it. So they decided to put it onto their first album. And Davis went down to meet with some lawyers to sign some documents so he would get the royalties from the recording. And the one lawyer said to Davis, you know, did you write this song? And he said, no, it was revealed to me. and they were like, well, you know, if you want to get the royalties and if you want to be paid, you know, why don't we say that you arranged that song and then you can sign that you're the arranger. And I don't know exactly if that's the right wording, but he did sign a document eventually, and he got $500 that day as like a signing advance. But then he got royalties from the album, and that album sold a lot. I mean, someone in the documentary said there was a lot of money going around in the folk revival, and that first Peter, Paul, and Mary album sold like crazy. He made enough money from that one songwriting credit to buy a house in Jamaica, Queens in 1968.
That's incredible. That is incredible. That really is. And, you know, it's kind of a fascinating thing when you think about it, the way some of these traditional songs and, you know, their writing credits were assigned or arrangements or what have you. And I think of A.P. Carter, who was shrewd in the fact that he discovered a lot of these early traditional or English songs and, you know, just heard them being sung around Mesa Springs or wherever in Virginia and decided, well, this is an A.P. Carter song, you know, and then suddenly, you know, it becomes this. So it's really kind of a fascinating strand of American music of to who got credit for doing what and where when it got popular. It really is.
Even like in rock and roll, like the Stones gave him a half a credit for You Gotta Move on Sticky Fingers. Like Led Zeppelin wasn't giving credit. They were stealing from Howlin' Wolf and everybody, and they weren't giving credit, but the Stones were giving credit. The Peter, Paul, and Mary, they were making sure people, you know, were getting songwriting credits because that's where the money was in the publishing.
Right.
And it is a weird thing because it's not really right. It's just like the songwriter shouldn't be getting all the money. The musicians do a lot of the work too, you know, and the singers.
Absolutely.
But that's the way that business works. So in this, especially back then, you know, you had to get that songwriting credit. And, you know, thank goodness for the Stones and Dylan and Peter, Paul, and Mary for giving Davis. And even the Dead, they recorded Death Don't Have No Mercy, which is another big Davis hit, and Samson and Delilah. And they played it live all the time. And so he and Annie got royalties from that stuff. And he was able to live pretty comfortably in his last, you know, 5 or 6 years of his life. Hopefully Annie, you know, was still getting royalties after he was gone, after he died in 72.
You read about Samson, you read about his verse. Was the strongest man that ever lived on earth. One day Samson was walking alone. He looked down on the ground, he saw an old jawbone. He lifted up that jawbone and he swung it over his head. And when he got to moving, 10,000 was dead.
If I had my way, if I had my way in this wicked world, if I had my way, I would tear this building.
Johnny ripped that beast, the lion
nose and cool black hair. Delilah, she climbed up my hands and knees. So tell me where your strength lies, if you please. She talks so fine, she talks so fair. Samson's and Delilah.
I didn't know what a legend he was at the time. I'm glad I didn't.